It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and today we are back on the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling from Japan, episode 33. By God, we've done 33 of these. We're going on with this. It's cool. We're in 1994, and we're looking at FMW, so you can understand it's going to be a bit crazy and fraught for the next 45 minutes to an hour. And to join me and dissect these two shows we're looking at today is Miss Chelsea Spollen of Shoulders Up. How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing okay. I'm excited to talk about some very weird wrestling.
Yeah, that's probably the best way of describing FMW, really, especially in this time period. How do you feel the products move forward? Because me and you have done all the FMW shows together, and I hope I haven't worn you out with gore and blood and barbed wire and all sorts of horrible things and some really, really bad wrestling and some cool and interesting stuff. So how, having seen it from the beginning in its infancy of independence at Currican Hall in front of 400 people with some barbed wire and some kickboxers, what do you think of the product now, 5 years later?
It is a lot better 5 years later. I still think my favorite thing about FMW is a lot of the really cool women's matches that the ladies get to have. I think the thing that, well, there's two things that really stand out about FMW at this point, I think. One of them is that it still feels like the island of misfit toys. It still feels like you can watch this card and see stuff you'll literally never see anywhere else. The other thing is that the thing that I think FMW does so well as a promotion is dramatic storytelling. There are a lot of matches on this anniversary show that we're about to talk about where I don't necessarily personally pop for something that happens while I'm watching it, but the crowd is like super into it. And there really aren't that many matches that I've seen of FNW where people were like, this is a recommended match that you should watch. This is cool, you know, or this is something that everybody talked about, whether they liked it or not, where the crowd isn't super invested in it. They had a very, very passionate fan base. And a lot of the guys who worked for this promotion who weren't the best technical wrestlers in the world could still tell a really intense dramatic story. I think that's just really, really cool. Like, I think there are a lot of wrestling promotions that have much higher quality technical wrestling, especially during this period, my God. You know, but don't have the ability to captivate such a large audience all at once doing really big things. So I think in that way, it's very, very successful in a lot of the goals that it's set for itself.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand this is a company that had no TV. TV companies would not touch this product. And on this particular card, we're looking at FMW's 5th anniversary show. They put 52,000 people into Kawasaki Baseball Stadium.
That's insane. And how is that possible? Like, I legitimately don't totally understand that. How did people, because the internet wasn't really a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how did people, like, learn about this?
Well, we talked before about, like, they had really high production values when it came to video production because of their association with that Laserdisc company, and that transferred to VHS. They did everything on VHS. You know, this was all through tape sales. I think Alan Blaylock, who tweets a lot on Twitter about wrestling, he described Progress Wrestling as the modern day equivalent of FMW. They have this massive national and international following done without TV. And it is kind of the same thing, but on a much, much bigger scale. And a lot of it came down to Anita. He was crossover. He was a crossover pop star. At this point, he was a spokesman for the Japanese government for sexual health.
Interesting.
Well, he did have a lot of sex. So, he was a massive crossover star. Anita was a lot of it. They certainly wouldn't have put 52,000 people in this building without him. And certainly when he retires, the drop-off is quite noticeable. However, you know, even then, you've still got to keep these people interested for 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like a lot of, I don't know, a lot of the FMW stuff I've watched, they manage to hold the attention of the crowd pretty much the whole time, which is really not easy to do. I've seen a lot of cards where I've watched wrestlers who I think of as being, you know, technically very, very adept, who can't do that.
Yeah, definitely. There's some good wrestling on this show and the next show we look at as well. But you know, this is good stuff. This is core good storytelling. I was watching some of the matches from the All Japan Carnival Tournament, which is the big All Japan show at the moment, for a podcast we're doing in a few weeks' time. And the wrestling isn't that far different from this. The All Japan stuff is much harder hitting, and the names are bigger because it's All Japan and it's the traditional company. But right. You can certainly see where King's Road Style influenced FMW and the layout of the matches and stuff. But it doesn't seem that different to me. Yes, All Japan's better because the wrestlers are better and because, you know, all of them have charisma and not everyone on this card has charisma. But it's still a very watchable product, FMW.
Yeah, I think FMW found some ways to make guys who were not, who didn't have that super intense star quality, they found a way to make them look like stars while they were working there, you know? And that's really cool.
Okay, then. Well, we're starting with... We're going to do two cards today. We're going to do the swimming pool death match, because you've got to do the swimming pool death match.
You have to.
And we're looking at the fifth anniversary show, which, like we said, happened on the 5th of May 1994 and attracted 52,000 people to Kawasaki Baseball Stadium, the biggest card at that arena ever as for wrestling, as far as I can remember. Now, the card opened with a singles match involving two rookies, as normally you do and find on a Japanese card, and it was Tetsuya Kuroda. He defeated Kasuki Yoshikawa in 9 minutes and 28 seconds. It was all right. It was a couple of rookies having a fairly good match. It was pretty competitive. What do you think, Chelsea?
I thought this was fine. You know, it was two dudes who were trying to make a name for themselves, and they're both clearly very competitive. It was very high energy. I don't know that it's necessarily the best wrestling that I've seen from a rookie match at the top of a card, but it's fine. I thought it was interesting that Kuroda won with the Boston Crab. That's a New Japan thing, right?
Yeah, you get a very basic moveset when you come out of the... when you come out of the dojo, and your finisher is always the Boston Crab. That's what you're allowed.
Did FMW have like a dojo that it was responsible for at this point? Like, was that still, were those still the rules, or was that just something he did?
I don't think that was the rules, but I think that was something he did that may well have been his finisher. But they certainly had a dojo at that point, because a lot of the women on the FMW shows were in that dojo at the time. Certainly, right. People in the next match, Misato Tanaka, Nakagawa, and Battle Ranger Z were all FMW trainees. So was Crushing Matamori, Shark Tishiko. Looking through this list, a lot of people on this card, basically.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So that kind of explains it. I saw that and I was like, oh, okay, I know what that is.
Okay, then. So we move on to the second match, which did indeed feature Battle Ranger Z, Koji Nakagawa, and a 12-year-old Masato Tanaka, who went on to much bigger and better things as a former ECW and FMW world champion. They defeated Hanzo Nakajima, Shairu, and the great Sasuke in 18 minutes and 49 seconds in FMW versus Michinoku Pro match. What did you think of this, Chelsea? Because this was an interesting change of pace for the FMW trainees to take on board.
This is so silly. This is so silly. Like, Michinoku Pro is, I mean, we've said many times, it's very similar to a lot of things about Chikara, but it's also, it's like tokusatsu influenced. It's like a Sentai show, right? So It reminds me of Power Rangers. So it's like watching Power Rangers have a wrestling match. Battle Ranger Z has a sort of lucha mask on, but like these big shoulder pads, and Shiryu, I think it is the one that has the black and white tiger stripe tights.
Yeah.
It's so inherently ridiculous. But what's really interesting is that those dudes are all really good wrestlers.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just silly comedy wrestling. It's guys who clearly bust their asses to get really good and get to a really high level of technical proficiency so that they can tell you really ridiculous stories.
I was going to say, Shiro is actually Kaz Hayashi, who was a mainstay in the cruiserweight division in WCW and still wrestles today for Wrestle 1 and is considered a very handy mid-card heel for the junior heavyweight division.
I mean, he's really, really good. I think my favorite moment in this match is, I think it's when he's in there with Tanaka.
Yeah.
And he does this, like, leapfrog, or he does, like, a leapfrog over him, and then a backflip, and then Tanaka charges at him, and then they both spin around and jump at the same time, and the crowd laughs, and it's just... It feels very theatrical. It feels a little bit like Broadway. There's nothing quite like Michinoku Pro. It's just, it's its own thing. It does its own thing, and that's why I think it's perfect on this card.
I think as well, like, Battle Ranger Z, the guy you would expect to be a Michinoku Pro wrestler, is actually an FMW wrestler.
Oh my god.
Which shows you the influence they had on FMW. Next, we had a six-woman tag match, which featured Eagle Saiwai and Mizuki Endo and Norio Titenano of LLPW fame, and they lost to Combat Toyota, Crusher Matamori, and Shark Tikisho of FMW Mad Dogs fame. This was an exceptionally good match, and the heat between Eagle Saiwai and Combat Toyota, the respective aces of their company, was palpable. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
I love Combat Toyota. Love the moment in this match where she jumps off the turnbuckle, and at first there's like three people on the ground who are going to try to catch her, and then two of those people back away as fast as they possibly can because they don't want that responsibility. I like Eagle Sawai in this match too. Eagle Sawai is one of those performers where about half the time I've seen her, I think she's good, but not as good as that other person standing next to her.
Yeah.
And that was kind of how I felt in this too, which I feel bad for her that that's the case, because I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's the conversation we have every time we talk about Joshi in the 90s, right? There's so much talent that there are lots of people who are really, really good who just don't stand out because they're being outshone. This is really fun, and everybody in this knows what they're doing. And some of them I tried to Google afterwards, and I couldn't really find. Like, I couldn't really find anything about Mizuki Endo, even though I thought she was good. I thought she was trying a little too hard to be like, who did she remind me of? She reminded me a little bit of Toshio Yamada and a little bit of Yumiko Hoda, but she's not on their level as far as charisma.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
but I still liked her, you know? I still was like, okay, I could see you evolving into something, and then I guess I couldn't really find anything about her career a few years after this, so I think she may have just retired.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a good match. It's an interesting Joshi match because I feel like a lot of the big Joshi intercompany tag matches that you watch from this time period are very serious.
Yes.
And this is competitive, but it's much looser. It's much more relaxed.
I think is what probably down to the fact that it's LLPW, not All Japan Women.
Yeah, so I think that does make a difference.
They're coming from two different places, whereas, like, well, Combat's a former AJW person with a massive chip on her shoulder, and a quite justified massive chip on her shoulder. And Matamori and Tichiko were trained by Toyota, so therefore they come from that AJW lineage, and Saiwai Endo and Titeano just didn't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is good, and it's fun, and it's definitely enjoyable if you like... If you like FMW as a product, you'll probably enjoy this match. It's interesting to me that a lot of the women in this match are better technical wrestlers than some of the dudes that are later on this card.
Yeah, they are. Speaking of which, the next match was Mr. Ganesuke and the lovable Sambo fighter Sambo Osaka. They defeated Goro Tsurumi and Hideki Hisaka in 12 minutes and 24 seconds in a perfectly serviceable brawl. I really kind of enjoyed this. There was a lot of fire into it, and Sambo Osaka had improved leaps and bounds in the previous 4 years of watching him on these anniversary shows slowly get beat up more and more and more. Mr. Ganesuke was a protege of Tarzan Goto and was a trainee of the FMW Dojo. He was also best friends with Hayabusa, who we'll talk about later on this show. But this was pretty good for what it was.
Yeah, this is fine. I I saw Hosaka with all the face paint, right?
Yeah.
And, like, the singlet, and I thought, dude, you're trying really hard to be Aja Kong, and you're not Aja Kong. I mean, he's fine. Like, it's just, you know, it's not... Nobody in this match stands out to me as being, like, super amazing, blow my mind, wow! You know, it's a perfectly serviceable match. It's good in terms of the crowd gets excited about it. People watching it were into it. I think I probably... It's one of those things where I watched it thinking, I would have enjoyed this more if I watched it live than watching it on my iPad.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think it's a heat thing, isn't it? Like, sometimes, like, if there's a lot of heat in a match, you kind of doesn't always translate through a TV set, does it?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's this thing that happens, especially when you watch a lot of wrestling, which I've been doing this week, where watching stuff on a screen kind of flattens everything out. And then when you see it in person, a lot of times performers who don't resonate with you when you watch them on TV will actually stand out to you as being really, really good when you see them in person. And
yeah,
maybe some of the dudes in this match would have hit me that way. The only reason I say that, it's not just that I'm trying, like, really hard to be nice. I'm saying that because the crowd liked this match a lot. So my feeling is that if I had seen it in person, I would have enjoyed it more.
Going back to Aja Kong, I've been watching a lot of Aja Kong for an article I'm writing at the moment. And when we get to the beginner's guide in 1999, you're going to cry a lot.
Okay.
Okay, just giving you a warning now.
Okay, I'm into it. Bring on the pain.
All right, then we'll move on to a different style match, which is Katsuji Ueda. Again, our favorite wrestling kickboxer who defeated Katsushi Naoyama, a wrestler, in 7 minutes and 43 seconds by knockout in a different style shoot fight match, which actually I think was probably the most enjoyable match I've seen Katsuji Ueda in, because he's not against some lumpy boxer who can't do anything. He's in against a wrestler, and it made it a worthwhile match, and it really gave Ueda a chance to shine and do the things he's really good at.
Yeah, this reminds me a little bit of how I feel when I watch Shayna Baszler wrestle now.
Yeah.
Because I can see her, whenever I watch her wrestle, fighting the training that she had for years that taught her how to actually, like, kill a person. and I think that's kind of what I'm seeing a little bit when I watch this match. Like, Ueda is trying to put on a decent show, and he does. This is very watchable, especially compared to some of the mixed match style shoot fight things that FMW has done are just, like, unwatchable. But this one is fine. You know, it's like you can get through it and stay invested. Ueda definitely has a little bit of that tension there, though, when he moves, where
yeah,
you can see him thinking, like, okay, the goal of this is not actually to kill the other person. I'm gonna hit him in the face. But, you know, I don't know. It's interesting. I can see why Onita probably, you know, I can see why he would book this, where he's like, I'm gonna get those two dudes who do very different things to beat the crap out of each other. This is, like, the only time I'm ever gonna say this. I almost wish it were a little more violent.
Yeah, to get some more drama into it a bit.
Yeah, there's some missing there. There's like there's an edge that's not there that is in a lot of the stuff that you normally get in FMW.
But at least it didn't go like 15 rounds and no one hit each other.
That's true. I kind of think this was supposed to be a shoot fight. I kind of think this wasn't a shoot fight, though.
No,
I mean,
no.
So
it was a nice exhibition.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Interesting you're saying about Shayna Baszler this week, because she's got a load of stick this week. We don't really tend to try and talk about current stuff, but she's got a load of stick this week for not running the ropes. Interesting story from Josh Barnett, who was on the Steve Austin podcast a couple of months ago now. And Shayna Baszler did want to be, like, full-on pro wrestler when she first came to Josh with the idea of her turning pro. And she had, like, costumes made and stuff. And Josh went, you're one of Billy Robinson's students. What would Billy say to you if he saw you dressed in that?
Wow.
And she said, you know he would kill you. He said, you are a shoot fighter. You've got no worries about being a pro wrestler. Just do what you do and you'll be fine. And that's the reason why she doesn't run the ropes, is because that's not what a fighter would do, which matches her character perfectly. And Josh was right in that sense. Yes, for some people it's a bit of a head switch, But Josh was a headliner in Japan for 10 years.
Yeah.
He does know what he's talking about with it. So, I don't know.
I have other feelings about her, but that's a bigger, longer podcast.
Yes, we will get to that in time, I'm sure. Moving on then. We go to a tag match, which was kind of fun and kind of interesting and kind of violent and kind of all sorts of things. Damien 666 and Sabu defeat Dr. Luther and Yoni Gajin, or Genjin, in 15 minutes and 14 seconds. Yes, Dr. Luther is formerly of the tag team of Dr. Luther and Dr. Hannibal, the overall wearing psychopaths, tagging with Yoni Gajin on this occasion. Damien 666 doing everyone's in the finishing maneuver in wrestling during this match, and Sabu being Sabu when he was really, really reckless before his knees gave in and before he broke his neck a couple of times. This was Sabu at his most Sabu, including trying to break a table with his knees at the end of the match, failing two or three times, but he was determined to go through it. Chelsea, what did you think of this?
This is nuts. Like, I actually wrote in my notes, what is this? The thing that always stands out to me about Sabu every time I watch him doing anything for FMW is that dude is so good. And I'm always sort of thinking, like, why is he putting himself through these things? I don't know if that dude has a death wish or what it is, but, like, I don't know. I mean, I know his recklessness is a big thing that people really, really like about him. But I look at that guy and I'm like, there are so many ways that you could make money doing this thing. Why are you doing this to your body? And this is another one of those matches that you can't watch without thinking, like, oh, those hard Japanese tables that don't break. LOL. what is Damien 666? What is that guy? What is his thing? What is he doing?
He's a long-standing luchador. If I remember correctly, he's still wrestling to this day. He was in WCW. He's certainly a AAA mainstay. Yeah, he's 56 years old, still wrestling. Of course he is.
Wow.
35 years. Technical brawler, hardcore. Trained by Rey Mysterio Sr., Diablo Velasco, Luis Canales, and Chimaco Rodriguez. He was a big star in ECW for a while as well. He cut on there too. And he kind of like was a big bad heel in AAA, but he found out, like, getting over in different places, he had to do more fun stuff. And like some of the stuff he does in this match is like borrowing other people's moves, and you'll hear it just like going Inoki, and then he'll put on a tarantula hold, an octopus stretch, and he'll do like Muta and pretend to throw mist and do a moonsault just because he likes that's the kind of stuff, and the crowd lapped it up.
Yeah, he does a Hulk Hogan impression at one point, and you can actually watch the joy on the faces of some of the fanboys in the audience, in the background. Like, it's, I don't know, it's funny because wrestling impressions either really, really work or they really don't. And for some reason it works for that guy. He's very charismatic, which is not what I expected from a guy in a black turtleneck and sweatpants and really, really terrible face paint.
It got better as he got older. His face paint in mid-period AAA was pretty good. You could actually tell he'd put sixes on his face and not just...
I'm skeptical, but I'll believe you.
I'll find you a picture to put up with the podcast when I post it, just to remind you.
Okay. Thanks, James.
Next, we have the six-man tag match with the glory of all the mullets in the world. This is by far and away the best hairstyle match you will ever, ever see. And it involves Big Titan, Rick Bogner, Ricky Fuji, the master of the mullet. I believe a mullet maestro, one might say. The Gladiator, Mike Awesome. And they defeated Ghetto. Yes, that Ghetto. Lead booker of New Japan Pro Wrestling Today and Age. Manager of the Rainmaker, Kazuchika Okada. That Ghetto. Hiromuchi, Fuyuki, and Jado. As in, yes, that Jado, world-class tag team Jado, in 15 minutes and 6 seconds in a thoroughly entertaining brawl, which really shone everybody was great in this match. I loved it. It was just brilliant, just really, really cool, and I enjoyed it. But it did lead to a breakup of the Big Titan Ricky Fuji Gladiator team, which had been the mainstay of the six-man division for the previous 4 years. And it was thoroughly good. And for Yuki, who gets a lot of stick for being an All-Japan mid-carder, really pulled his weight in this match. I really enjoyed it. Everyone was doing cool stuff, I thought. What did you think, Chelsea?
This is really good. This is... It's so weird. Like, I don't know how to completely describe this match. It doesn't really feel like anything else that I've watched that's not FMW. It feels like something very unique to FMW. Jado and Gato, it's always a little weird for me to see them when they're, like, young and still really actively doing stuff. You know what I mean? Because I'm so used to them just being, like, guys who wear cool clothes who show up and make snarling faces for 5 minutes, and that's kind of it. It was kind of a trip seeing them in those, like, the scoop neck halter top things. Like, I don't know if the point was to show off their midriffs or not, but good job, guys. I got a kick out of Ricky Fuji dressed like, he reminded me of when you see Olympic skiers on television before and after, where they're sitting down with, like, news people in those, like, bright jackets with the sunglasses, and they're talking about how cool they are. Like, I don't know if that was his inspiration or not, but that's the first thing I thought of. And then, you're right, the hair. There's some really interesting hairstyle choices in this match. Big Titan is one of those dudes who, when I've seen him before, either just kind of lumbers around or does really cool things where I'm like, how does a guy that size pull that off? He does a suicide dive in this match. He gets caught by two dudes who probably don't even come up to his shoulders. And I was impressed that he was willing to do that, because he really very easily could have broken his neck. When he launches himself over the rope, he's like flailing his arms around in the air for a second. They're like, oh God, this is happening. It's very entertaining. I'm very hit or miss on Mike Awesome. I either get into it or I don't. I like his power bombs. They're cool. But he's one of those wrestlers that I don't know if whatever his shtick is really works for me. That said, I think he was a good utility player in this match. Did I miss anybody?
No, I think everybody? You got him. Fuyuki. What did you think of Fuyuki?
Fuyuki got some huge pops in this match, which was interesting because I don't really know that much about that guy. But there's one moment where he takes a series of, like, chops to the chest, I think, and then he screams back at his opponent, and the crowd gets behind him. They get into it. I think, to me, he has a little bit of that everyman quality that Atsushi Onita has, where dudes watching him who are sitting there, like, you know, feeling like they feel alienated from the guys who are like the power fantasy, you know, the wrestlers with the really amazing bodies and the perfect hair.
Why Big Time?
Right. They might get into that guy because he's more on their level. And so, like, it's a power fantasy fulfillment thing that, like, an ordinary dude can do cool stuff like that. I don't know.
No, I completely agree with you. I think that's just about right. I mean, Fuyuki was an All Japan regular. He was a basically preliminary mid-card guy, and then he left with Jinichiro Tenryu and went to War. At this point, those three are probably the best six-man tag team in the world at the time. They were their War six-man tag team championships. They had big feuds with various people over the next couple of years over those championships. And Fuyuki, and eventually all three of them end up in FMW, and Fuyuki ends up being lead booker when Onita finally leaves FMW. So in the late 90s, we watched the next card, and on the beginning of the next card is a series of house shows that lead up to the Swimming Pool Explosion Deathmatch, which we'll talk about in a bit. And by that point, Big Titan and Gladiator were having kind of a scientific wrestling match feud. And that was really interesting to watch. Watch those two guys just have a straight-up wrestling match. No violence, just have a wrestling match to try and prove who was the best guy. And that was really entertaining. And Big Titan, actually, I've always thought he was useless. And then I watched this match, and actually, he's in these matches, and he's telling a story, and he's doing some spots, and he's got a lot of stuff going on with him. And it's like,
he cares.
Yeah.
Clearly he cares. Even though there are some early matches where I'm like, that guy's not very good, I think he really did want to be.
Yeah, I think he would. And, you know, you like, WWE had this guy, and they turned him into fake Razor Ramon. What were you doing?
I mean, that's a whole other conversation, isn't it?
It is. Oh, the mistakes Vince has made. Anyway, next up is two actual bona fide legends doing incredibly horrible things to one another. Terry Funk defeats The Sheik by knockout in 5 minutes and 59 seconds, because really that's all The Sheik could do at this particular point. And it's not really a wrestling match. It's two middle-aged and, well, old guys just wandering around a Kawasaki baseball stadium trying to set fire to each other for 5 minutes and 59 seconds. And that's all you can say. The Sheik at this point was in his early 60s and was relatively immobile. You notice he didn't get in the ring very often because it was really hard work for him to do that. But he was still a big star and he was still a big draw to the FMW crowd. What did you think of this match, Chelsea?
He wouldn't get in the ring because that was too hard for his knees, but he would take a bunch of chair shots.
Yeah. Because he's the Sheik and that's what he does.
This is the only match I've ever seen where Terry Funk has an opponent who's older than him. It's still really good. I don't know. It's not really a pure wrestling match. It's just, it's storytelling. It's very emotional in places. Like, there's Terry Funk bites the Sheik's forehead and there's blood and there's probably some bleeding. Probably.
Yeah.
It's hard not to root for those guys. And I think I sound so puzzled when I say that, because when Terry Funk came out, I'm like, okay, Terry Funk has done some really cool stuff in FMW. I totally get it. And then when I saw his opponent was the Sheik, I'm like, yeah? Is that going to work? And it does. I got really emotionally invested in a back rake during this match. That doesn't happen to me very often. They beat the crap out of each other. And the fact that they're willing to do that and put their bodies through it and still comes across as very competitive, even though, let's be honest, if Terry Funk really wanted to beat the crap out of the Sheik and wasn't actually trying to have a pure wrestling match with him, it wouldn't have been very difficult.
No. I mean, if you go back to the matches they had in the 70s in Detroit, where they're 10 times more mobile, both of them are, and Funk's probably the best wrestler in the world at that particular point. And he's having breathtaking matches with the Sheik, who was never a great in-ring worker. That wasn't the point. He was an attraction. You know,
right.
You didn't go to see the Sheik to go see a classic wrestling match. You went to see the prayer mat and the distract the referee and the fork and the bleeding and the bleh. You know, he's a monster heel. That's what you go to see.
Right.
You know, but they were having thoroughly great matches in the 1970s. Now, they've both slowed down a step or seven, but they are amazing in this match.
Yeah, they really understand each other. And a thing that I think the crowd really reacts to is that they're both so confident. They're both so absolutely, completely sure of themselves. And I mean, you have to be, I guess, I would hope so, in order to try to set somebody else on fire while you're both, like, you know, not wearing a shirt or anything to protect yourself. Like, everything they do in this match has to really hurt a lot. And they both just, it's not even right to say that they soldier through it, because it doesn't look like effort a lot of the time. It's
no.
Just what they do.
They're on it. They're in the zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, kindly Uncle Terry isn't that kindly when he's in the right mood.
Yeah, it's definitely, especially if you're used to Terry Funk from, like, way earlier in his career or way later in his career, it's definitely worth watching this because it's very interesting.
Just listening to that, because you can hear that Uncle Terry voice as well when he's, like, stood on the chop right going, Sheik, where are you, you son of a bitch, Sheik?
Yeah! That's a really good impression, actually.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. I do work on my Terry Funk. We actually missed a match here, and it was probably the best match on the card, so we should go back to that.
I was going
to
say!
The FMW I Independent and WWA Women's title match was Megumi Kudo, the then champion, defending against Yumika Hotta successfully in 16 minutes and 48 seconds. This was fantastic. And like I said, probably the best match on the card. We've only got two others to talk about, and they're both kind of like stories to tell. This was more of a straight-up wrestling match. Yumika Hotta in all her leg-swinging glory against the sweet science of Megumi Kudo. Chelsea, what did you think of this? I have a feeling you're going to like it.
Oh, this is really, really good. Yumika Hotta is such a badass. I love her. I love how much the crowd loves her, because I've never seen a single match she had, including her like debut after she, you know, started as a rookie, where the crowd didn't react to her. Like,
She
comes out, she's a badass, she knows it, the crowd makes noise for her like she's a badass. They know it. I like that she came out in this weird, I'm going to say it, almost ugly, like hoppy coat that she's wearing, like the purple and the yellow, and then this gold on the other side. And then I was sort of thinking, I'm like, what do you wear to match that? And then Megumi Kudo comes out dressed like, how do I explain it? It's like this super, super shiny pink and gold robe that looks like either like a dancer in the background of a 1950s movie or like a game show hostess. It's got a bunch of the flare feathers on the hem. It's just so ostentatious. And then when she takes it off, she's dressed like the pink Power Ranger.
That's a good description. I've heard that before.
Right? And then they're standing in the ring looking at each other before the match starts, and you forget about what they're wearing because it ceases to matter. There is some genuine tense competitiveness in this match, and I think some of that is just that Yumiko Hoda, I've never seen her have a match where she wasn't really fighting for it, you know?
Yeah,
even when she's winning, she's like, I am the best, and I know it, and I'm going to run you over to prove it, and I love that. Megumi Kudo is super underrated, I think, in terms of her technical skill. I hear lots of people talk about the abuse that she'll put her body through, and that's definitely true. I've seen her get electrified before. Like, I know she's the hardcore queen for a reason, but for someone who's known primarily as a hardcore wrestler, she's also a really good mat wrestler, and she has counters for people's counters. Like, she does a really cool victory roll in this match. She does a beautiful, I think it was a frog splash attempt that Yumiko Hoda thwarts with her knees.
Yeah.
That looks very painful. It's really interesting watching the two of them wrestle, because while it's not on that next level tier that some of the Joshi singles feuds of this era are on, it's still better than 98% of anything you're going to see on a Ring of Honor pay-per-view now. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's still, at least to me personally.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
It's still really good, stiff wrestling that's also really technically adept. And Kudo, when she pulls off the win, it's this beautiful reversal of, it's either a powerbomb or like an electric chair drop, I forget. And when she does it, there are so many moments in the match leading up to that where she either has like a botch, or she goes for a move and she can't pull it off. And maybe it wasn't a botch. Maybe that was intentional, you know? Yeah. So when she wins, it feels like she's just narrowly escaped with the victory. And she seems so excited about it. And then right after she's excited about it, she gets this moment where it almost hits her like a punch, where she's like, oh my God, I actually did that. And I don't know. It's very emotionally investing, even though I don't know anything about the dynamic between those two women at all. I have no idea what their interpersonal relationship is like, or if they have one at all. I just instantly gravitated towards the two of them in this match. I got totally sucked in and enjoyed the whole thing.
I think as well is because the expectation isn't as high, because it's not Toyota versus Kudo, and it's not like Akira Hokuto versus Kudo. It's Hotta is great, don't get me wrong, but you know, you're going to be pleasantly surprised by how great this match is, because they both get a chance to shine, which isn't something necessarily that Hotta had a chance to do in AJW.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I necessarily... So this is my take on Yumiko Hoda, right? And this is very, very weird. Very weird. Mm. There's a way in which she reminds me of Sasha Banks. Because Sasha is counted upon in WWE to be the person who makes things work and gets the crowd excited. Because the crowd loves her, right?
Yeah.
And gets people over, even though she's often better than the person she's wrestling, and possibly even more deserving. Yumiko Hoda is that person a lot of the time, and the crowd knows it. AJW's management didn't act like... That's not even true. They know it, too. They know it, too, in a lot of the matches I've seen her in. They understand exactly what she is and how to use her to make things electrifying. But they're not going to give her her due. They're not going to give her the reward that she deserves for the things that she does. And I don't know. I you can really see it.
I mean, I guess the modern-day equivalent is Tomohiro Ishii in New Japan today. You know, he's the guy, he's never going to win the world championship, but he's going to go 45 minutes and kill himself in the attempt, but he knows he's never going to win.
See, I get that. But yeah. Ishii gets a level of respect from yes. the New Japan Pro bookers that I don't think Yumiko Hata gets.
No.
I think women who end up in that position in wrestling where they're the technical expert who is also a fan favorite who can get people over always get screwed in a way that men who are in the comparable position do not. Because the men, the promotions that they work for make room for them.
Mm.
And the women, it doesn't happen that way. Like, Vince McMahon is happy to let Sasha Banks sell t-shirts for him. He's still never going to let her win a title defense.
Hmm. Yes, I see where you're coming from with this. Hmm. All right.
Anyway.
Yes. Moving on. The next, the semi-main event was the FMW Brass Knuckles World Tag Team Street Fight Championships, which was then held by Hisgatsu Oya and Mr. Pogo. Yes, that's that Mr. Pogo. With some natty new belts that they brought to the ring and then promptly hit Mitsuhiro Masanaga and Tarzan Goto in the head with them. This was a street fight. It did what it said on the tin. It was a lot of fun for what it was. Again, this is the guys coming out of Wing, because Wing had closed down at this point. Mr. Pogo jumped back to FMW. Oya was actually a New Japan guy who'd ended up in Wing, and he came as well. Matsunaga was a Wing guy who was tagging with Taz and Goto because Pogo and Oya didn't trust him. And had kicked him out of the Wing group. And this was a 16-minute and 30-second match of that story. And I thought it was thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah, this is really good. It's really interesting because Tarzan Goto, in terms of the level of technical wrestling acumen that he has, may be one of the worst wrestlers on this card, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Every single thing he does gets a huge reaction out of the crowd. Like, he can knock somebody down with a clothesline and people lose their shit. I sort of feel similarly about Mr. Pogo in the sense that he is beloved. I mean, I didn't realize, actually, truthfully, this is kind of sad, but I didn't realize until he passed away, and then all of a sudden there were these very tearful, very touching memorials for him all over social media, that dude is genuinely beloved in the minds of wrestling fans who watched him and grew up watching him. But I don't watch that guy in the ring and think of him as being, like, great shakes as a particular style of wrestler. You know, he's perfectly fine, but he's not next level at anything, you know. But it doesn't matter, because whatever it is, I can't totally put my finger on it. He has that it factor. Like, whatever it is that he did it so well that people still responded to it. And there's a sort of weird way in which all the guys in this match, I don't know if it's maybe just that Tarzan Goto and Mr. Pogo pull people up with their star power. Maybe that's some of it. But everybody in this match looks like a star while they're having it. And I think that's why it's enjoyable.
Well, I mean, Matsunaga started off in WKA, who's one of the early guys in Wing, in FMW. And when the WKA FMW talent exchange ended, he and Mr. Aoyagi went to New Japan Pro Wrestling. They had a couple of years there. In fact, me and I think Alex talked about him on the War show we'd reviewed a couple of weeks ago. So this is only about a year later. And Matsunaga was a massive draw for Wing. He was the ace of the company. He would feud with Anita later in this year, and they would have a big drawing match because it was considered the first time an ace had wrestled an ace in deathmatch wrestling, you know. So it was
Really interesting.
And in fact, Anita was very high on him to take over the ace position when he finally retired. He didn't, because the rest of the FMW management didn't think that he was as big a draw as that. Ended up being the only man in history to be, I can't remember who he was wrestling, but he wrestled somebody in a piranha jungle match, which literally was a wrestling match around a tank of piranhas. There you go. Anyway, he was a bit crazy. And we'll probably get to that at some point, no doubt.
Well, no wonder Onita liked him.
Yeah, he was willing to do anything to get over in a wrestling match. And good luck to him. But there you go. And then we get to the main event. A no ropes exploding barbed wire cage death match featuring Genichiro Tenryu. Yes, that Genichiro Tenryu. And he defeated Atsushi Anita in 23 minutes and 55 seconds. But let's scoot back a bit. Anita needed a big story for this show. He'd already wrestled Pogo. He'd wrestled everyone who was available to him within FMW. He needed an outside star to make this show pop. Now, Tenryu was the outside star he picked. He had worked with him as a young boy in All Japan Pro Wrestling. He was one of Baba's chosen ones, as was Tenryu. That relationship was played over on FMW videotapes and on War TV in the run-up to their first match, which was a tag match, which Anita partnered with Goto, and he pins Tenryu in a bloody brawl in a pretty even-tempered match, but he manages to get the Thunderfire Powerbomb on him. Tenryu challenges him to a match on his home turf, which ends up being a no-ropes-exploding barbed wire cage death match, which meant they could have a bit more of a wrestling match than if it was, you know, a time bomb match on, and it wanted to be something different from the time bomb match he'd had with Terry Funk the year before. So this was, you know, already big. And then Anita puts on the line his career. If he cannot beat Tenryu, he says he's going to retire. And that is what blew the attendance through the roof. 52,000 people wanted to see Anita retire, or wanted to see if he could beat Tenryu for a start. And if he was going to retire, this was going to be his last match. Now, as both of us know, Anita didn't actually retire until last November. But we'll hang that on the back burner, because that becomes the story of FMW for the next 2 years, essentially. What did you think of this match, Chelsea, and what do you think of this idea of this taking a big star who'd never done deathmatch wrestling before and bringing him into this environment?
Man, this is a masterclass in dramatic storytelling. Everything about the way they filmed this, before the match starts, is set up to give you a very very clear sense of how grand and important it is. Like, there are these beautiful shots of the stadium with all these people in it, and the camera gets far enough back that you can really see how many people there actually are. They stretch for, it looks like, miles. And the ring is the only thing illuminated in the middle. And it's just like, it's this beautiful, very quiet shot that gives you a moment to, like, let it sink in. You know, you have this, like, very pretty ending of a sunset sort of around it in the background, and it's dark, and then in the middle of it is this bright, shiny spectacle. And then when the two wrestlers come out before the match even starts, I think you get a minute and a half of them just looking at each other.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, very slow-paced, and brilliantly slow-paced.
Right, and it really lets you settle in. It really lets you, like, it kind of grabs you by the throat and is like, hey, you're going to pay attention to this. You're going to get invested in it. You're going to watch this thing we're going to do for you. Onita has that movie star quality, which is weird because I don't look at that guy, like, you know, still photos of him and think, oh, he's a classic leading man, because he's not. But it doesn't matter. For whatever reason, he just has that thing that makes you pay attention. I like the idea of having somebody who doesn't normally participate in death matches have this match with him, because there are moments in this match where it feels like Onita is sort of shepherding Tenryu through it, where he's like leading him through it and showing him this is what you do. And it still feels in other ways very even-footed, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's Onita's turf, and it's the stakes are high for him. But Tenryu is also the one of the two of them who has, like, you know, he's got this big reputation independent of deathmatch wrestling. And I mean, he could leave and then go do something else very easily, something far less dangerous, and be totally fine. If this doesn't work out for him, he's going to be okay. But he's so invested in it, and you know, like, a lot of Onita's best matches are with people who are technically much better wrestlers than he is.
Yeah.
You get some of that, too, where he's kind of, like, leading him through a lot of the mat wrestling portion of it. And then it goes quite a while before anybody actually ends up touching the barbed wire, right? I mean, I think it's at least, like, 10, 15 minutes, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. This was way held off on the big bumps on this one.
Yeah, yeah. And you're anticipating it so much before it happens, you know? And I think that's the trick to all these time bomb matches, is you're waiting even while you're watching something that has nothing to do with the barbed wire. The barbed wire is right there around you. Like, the way it's filmed, the camera's on the outside of the barbed wire, so you can see it the whole time. You can't ever forget that it's there.
Yeah.
So you're really tense the whole time, wondering, is somebody going to get electrocuted and what's going to happen to them? I don't know. I'm sorry, James. I forget the nature of your question. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. And I'd agree with you. I mean, Tenryu is a massive star at this point. He's probably the biggest single name in Japanese wrestling. He's carrying an entire promotion by himself with War. You know, there are some big names in War, but he's much, much bigger than anyone else in War. You know, he's come off a feud with Hulk Hogan to come do this. Like, he was wrestling for Hulk Hogan in SWS the year before this. Then he comes to Anita to wrestle this. He's about big money name matches. He's the guy you get to fill a gate, and he's certainly doing that job here. But that doesn't mean he's phoned it in. He's actually done some deathmatch style wrestling. This is really weird. This is like placing, I don't know, Randy Orton in Big Japan Pro Wrestling for a week and seeing what happens.
Yeah.
You know, he would have to take bumps into barbed wire and broken glass, so he'll have to do that.
It's like if Randy Orton had a really, really high stakes tables match or something with Okada. I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange but beautiful at the same time.
Yes.
It is. And for FMW, that pretty much told the story of 1994. It was a long year where they made a lot of money. Because Anita lost this match, he couldn't wrestle anymore. But they found a loop. They didn't say when he would retire, did they? So he announced his retirement for the main event of the anniversary show the following year in 1995, and they went on a tear. At this particular point, I was looking at the cage match dates earlier today to try and find matches on for what was on the rest of these tapes, and they were putting on shows nearly every day. This, in November, which is where the swimming pool match happens, they ran like 16 or 17 shows before the 25th of September that year. So, you know, this was busy, busy period. This was the period of time when they were the first to get a $100,000 gate at Currican Hall, a 2,000-seat hall.
That's nuts.
Yeah, this was they were making hand over fist. They were making money hand over fist. And then they come up with this idea of the Jingo Pool Stadium, no ropes exploding barbed wire, dynamite pool elimination death match. Shall I explain that, Chelsea, or do you think listeners will get it from that title?
I think it's worth expanding on a little.
Okay, so you get Jingo Pool Stadium, which I believe was the Olympic pool stadium for the 1960s. You put a pontoon in the middle, you put a wrestling ring on that pontoon. With me so far? Okay. You get wrestlers who are delivered by speedboat brilliantly to the ring, and then for the main event they take down the ropes as always because it's FMW. They replace two sides with barbed wire. They leave two sides open, and then if you are thrown out of the pool and into the water, water mines go off upon contact, as well as the barbed wire being electrocuted because it's exploding barbed wire. Just there you go. That's pretty much it. And it's elimination. So if you throw somebody out, you just keep going until you've got one person left on your team.
Yeah. But nicely said. I think that paints a picture.
Should we go through the whole card, or should we just pick out highlights?
To be honest, a lot of this card is not that great. Like the video that the pool deathmatch is at the end of. Is I think it's like three different events that they put together.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of it feels very flat. There are some standouts, but I would rather not do the whole thing because some of it is just, I don't know, maybe it's me personally. Some of it is not really my cup of tea. Some of it is not as grand as the stuff on the anniversary show.
Yeah. I would point you towards the feud between Big Titan and Mike Awesome, because that's pretty good.
Yes.
Hayabusa's return from, well, you know, coming back as Hayabusa from his excursion and wrestling Sabu in an outstanding match, which Sabu shakes his hand, which was unusual because Sabu was a heel. So that was worth watching. Mm-hmm. There's Combat Toyota nearly losing to a rookie from the FMW dojo, which is quite interesting to watch because that's a good case of how good Combat Toyota was at carrying people. On this particular card... the only thing that really stands out to me is the six-man tag match with Combat Toyota, Megumi Kudo, and Miya Sato. By this time, Combat Toyota had turned face against the Mad Dogs, Matamori, Iwama, and Toshiko, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah. I really like Combat Toyota as a face. And seeing her on the same side as Megumi Kudo, after watching a bunch of stuff where they were against each other or not anywhere near each other at all, is refreshing because they just like it's like watching really good really good ice dancers or really good pair skaters, you know? Like, they're just a well-oiled machine, the two of them together. Even when they're not the only people on their side, it just works. What is the name of the rookie that she almost...
Was it Mio, Mio Sato?
Was it? Then Mio Sato is in the tag team match on their side after that. So that's really interesting. I don't know that much about Mio Sato, but I really liked her in the six-man match. And I guess Tarzan Goto was her trainer?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I think she's a much better wrestler than he is.
Well, she was only active for 8 years, which is probably about the life of FMW, really, I guess. So, but yes, I completely agree with you. But yeah, it was interesting. It was a good match. It kind of really showed where the women's division was at this particular time. And much bigger things would come for the women's division in the next 12 months. The next match on the semi-main event was really interesting because that was Mitsuhiro Masanaga, who had by that point turned on Tarzan Goto because Yukihiro Kanemura, or Winger Kanemura, had turned up and swayed him to go back to his wing roots. Hisakatsu Aoa had turned from being a wing guy to being an FMW guy, was tagging with Tarzan Goto in this match, and then turned on him in mid-match. And Tarzan Goto had to fight off all three guys for 15 minutes, but eventually the numbers game didn't work. He got beat up and had to be saved by Atsushi Inita, which was really cool storytelling because Inita dived into the swimming pool, fully dressed because he's going to a street fight, so he's got jeans and a t-shirt and wrestling boots on, swims to the wrestling ring to save Goto, and then swims back again to start his main event match.
Yeah, Onita is, at times, it's sort of like he's the only person playing a large multiplayer game in God mode.
That's
like, you know that his will shapes everything that you're seeing happening around you, and also that he can do pretty much whatever he wants and he's gonna somehow survive it. And that's kind of how that moment felt to me. Also, the match was very good before he showed up. It was very, very interesting, dramatic storytelling.
Yeah, because obviously Goto's stuck in the swimming pool. He can't get anywhere, and he has to handle all three of them, and he managed it.
Yeah, he's... It's interesting because you don't look at Tarzan Goto and think, well, that's a guy who's going to be super successful as a huge wrestling star, but it's impossible not to root for him.
Yeah, he's a cuddly monster, isn't he? It's the beard.
I don't necessarily know that I think he's cuddly, but I want to see what that guy's going to do, and also he's so determined. He doesn't back down, you know? And I like that. I respect it.
Yeah. There you go. Then we get to the main event, which Anita swam back for, which pitted him, Katsushi Niyama, who was not a young boy. He'd graduated from the dojo at this particular point, and Mr. Ganesuke, another FMW loyalist, as they took on Hideki Hosaka, Mr. Pogo, and the Gladiator in this interesting match, because it's an elimination match, which is something we haven't seen before. Adds another level of drama. What I did miss was the crowd seemed an awful long way away from the ring.
And the crowd noise tends to get lost
because it's FMW in this period, and the crowd are usually lit, really, really alive for these particular
matches.
There are
many beers in by the time they get to the main event, too.
Yeah, especially like if you watch like Kurikan Hall matches for FMW at this point, the crowd's crazy. Like, more noise than you hear for like Kenny Omega and Okada in K-Hall today. K-Hall in the 90s must have been such an alive place to watch wrestling in, you know, because everything was rammed, jammed to the rafters. They used to put people up in the rafters at the time. They don't do that anymore, I think possibly because it was reasonably unsafe.
Yeah.
This was a bit weird because it didn't have that FMW vibe of the live crowd, but it was very watchable. What did you think of these stipulations? What did you think of this match? And what did you think of the layout of it?
It is, so it's not my favorite of the death matches, but it is such smart, dramatic storytelling. It's the thing I keep saying, you know, every time I talk about FMW, I'm sorry, it gets repetitive. It's interesting because I don't think the drama of it suffers from how weird the format is.
Mm.
You know? I do agree that it is disappointing that the crowd is so far away. On the other hand, it does kind of give the match, the setting of the match, this almost like displaced, slightly ethereal quality, because it feels so separate from everything else, even though you have all these guys who are very familiar to you, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's successful in what it attempts to do artistically, in that it's something nobody had seen before. I don't think anybody's tried to do it since, right? I think this is the only one.
No, this is it. Yeah.
I don't think anyone will ever do this again. It seems very unlikely. I don't know how many people would be willing to risk getting electrocuted and dying nowadays. I don't know. It's the thing that people talk about when they talk about this tape. People buy this VHS, or used to buy this VHS, and watch this whole tape just to get to this main event.
Yeah.
I think the actual layout of the match itself, what happens in the ring, is very secondary to the format and very secondary to Onita himself. And that could just be for me personally. Like, he's very much the focal point of this match for me. I don't know that I necessarily think it's like a great wrestling match, but I still also think that everybody who enjoys hardcore matches should watch it.
Yeah.
You know, like it's one of those things. It's like, check it off the bucket list. You gotta see this. You gotta see what this thing is. You have to see these guys figure out this very weird way to mine emotion out of each other and out of the crowd. And it's also interesting to me because you sort of think that, like, for some reason, I guess my assumption was because it was going to be in the middle of a swimming pool that it would maybe be less gory than some previous matches. And then there's a baseball bat covered in barbed wire.
Yeah.
So I was wrong to assume that.
Oh, we should give a heads up warning about the sickle use and fireballs from Mr. Pogo throughout this videotape.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome in places.
Yes.
If you like CZW or things like that, you probably already seen this. But if you haven't somehow and you like things like that, you'll probably enjoy this. There's a lot of blood everywhere by the end of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting because they make this stuff that people call a lot of wrestling like this garbage wrestling, you know?
Mm.
And there's a point where Onita, I think, pours gasoline all over his opponent and then tries to set him on fire. And while he's pouring the gasoline on him, dumps some of it in his mouth and pours it all over his face. And it still feels dramatically important.
Even,
yeah. Like, it's not garbage. It's a bunch of people who, for various reasons, may have been told by the rest of society that they're trash. But it's not garbage. It's a pretty solid artistic statement. I don't know. It's hard for me to... I feel like I'm talking around it. It's hard for me to get at the heart of it because it's so weird. But it's very interesting.
I think it comes from the same kind of attitude to life that you had in Britain in the 1970s. And this is going to sound odd, but like, bear with me.
Sure.
You look at the bands that come out of Birmingham, this depressingly oppressive industrial town in the 1970s when the economy's falling apart and everyone works in a factory and life's rubbish. And you get bands like Black Sabbath, and then later on you get Judas Priest, and then you go into the 80s and you get Napalm Death. You know, and you look where this match is. It's in, well, this one's in Tokyo, but where is the home of FMW? It's Kawasaki. The place where the place where Japan builds everything, this industrial heartland. And people, you know, hardworking, working class people need an outlet, and FMW was Kawasaki's outlet for me. That's the reason why this works, this company works, why they drew so big. Yes, it's at the end of a bullet train line, it's not that far from Tokyo. But to me, Kawasaki matches FMW perfectly, just like Philly and ECW and Mid-South Wrestling couldn't exist anywhere else except Memphis. It just is geography matched with emotion, matched with storytelling, and trying to relate to an audience that needs something to release. And this was their release. And there's nothing more purely artistic than that. You know, yes, they made tons and tons of money. Hand over fist, made more money than any promotion in Japan in a such short a period of time. And they burnt out all their artistic options far too quickly. And they had heavy injuries, as this kind of style of wrestling will give. But this was making a statement for the people that love this style of wrestling. And that's just as valid as anything WWE do, anything New Japan do, anything Impact Wrestling does. It's just condensed into something that was much more closer to the audience it was trying to attract.
Yeah. I don't think I could have said it any better than that.
Yeah. That's
hit the nail right on the head.
Thank you. I think that's it to me. It just seems like you couldn't have FMW in any other era of wrestling. No one was going to open their minds that much. You know, you look at the other promotions of the time, All Japan and New Japan were the two most conservative professional wrestling promotions on the planet. New Japan haven't run, probably run about 15 gimmick matches in the last 20 years. All Japan have run about 3 by this particular point. And so to me, it's just like there was a market for something that was different, and Anita and FMW found that market.
I don't even know that they necessarily found it. I think they created it to some extent.
Yes, I would agree with that, yeah. But they were certainly reflecting an audience that was there that just needed to find the right thing, you know. That's the way I look at it anyway.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it explains the very profound devotion that a lot of people feel. Even like modern fans of FMW who probably weren't watching it when it was in its heyday, who are probably watching it all retrospectively, like, you know, the way I am. It really explains some of the reverence that people have for it, like how affectionate they feel towards it. It certainly speaks to the level of like profound sadness and also appreciation a lot of people expressed when Onita finally really did retire recently.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There was a great outpouring of emotion, you know, and especially, like you said, when Mr. Pogo passed away, there was a bunch of wrestlers. Chris Brooks is a guy, as in CCK, Chris Brooks of Progress and Fight Club Pro. You know, he's a guy who grew up on Mr. Pogo and Anita and FMW and that style of wrestling. He doesn't wrestle really much like that. But there was a lot of Mr. Pogo in the Chris Brooks Obey Brooks character, certainly, you know. So,
well, it's interesting. You know, now that you've said that, I totally get that, but I never would have thought of it if you hadn't said it.
Yeah, but it's not like he's going around attacking people with a sickle and having a bottle of lighter fluid in his back pocket. But it is like it's that attitude that Pogo had to a wrestling match, that reckless do or die attitude of I'm going to win this whichever way I can, but I'm not sure how, but I will. And that's what Brooks brings to it, you know. So I can completely see where he would be influenced by him. Right then. Well, that closes the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling for today, episode 32. My name is James Trupany. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star. I appreciate you listening to the show today. I would like to thank my guest at this time of Shoulders Up. That's Miss Chelsea Spollen. Thank you, Mom.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
And you can find Chelsea at Chelsea Comics, well, it's our own account, but she tweets mostly about wrestling at shoulders_up. And you can find some really cool threads and ideas about the current Golden Lovers situation there.
Yeah, there's sorry for the high saturation of GIFs, but sorry not sorry.
Okay, you can find the show at Trupany Show on Twitter and the Trupany Show on Facebook, and please do find our Patreon page and pledge. We would greatly appreciate it, because if you can help us, we can keep the Trupany Show free forever for everyone, and we really appreciate that if you did. Also, if you're listening on iTunes, please give us a review. It would be beautiful if you did. It helps the algorithm. It means more people find out about us. We really appreciate your time listening today. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care. Bye.